Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining us this afternoon for this curatorial conversation on the work of Carol Itter. My name is Melanie O'Brien. I'm the acting director and curator here at the Belkin. And we are gathered here today on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam. And we at the Belkin are reckoning with our roles in the systems of ongoing colonization and in the responsibilities of the processes of decolonization. So the event today is an opportunity to reflect on what makes Carol Itter's practice such an enduring one, and to assess her ongoing relevance within contemporary art practices and discourse. We are hoping that this event lasts for an hour, and it's also being recorded. So if you are asking a question at the end, please be advised that it is recorded. Carol's work is something that really is enduring in the way that it responds to various social mores, to collective behaviors, to ideals of freedom and modes of constraint, and increasingly feels very visible for the way that it responds to capitalist extraction, consumption, and expansion through her acts of collective living, close looking, collecting, and reusing. So this current exhibition, which is entitled Carol Itter, Only If I'm Hauling Water, Do I Wonder If I'm Getting Any Stronger, is the first show to bring together a selection of the artist's multidisciplinary works and archival materials from the late 1950s to the present. And I say the late 1950s because we do have one archival drawing from her time at UBC in 1958. And this exhibition is really spurred on by Carol's archives, which were donated by the artist to the Belkin very recently, and has allowed me in particular to do some very deep thinking about her practice through the archives and being in her studio. Pouring through the archive and being in her studio, I was really struck by her ongoing commitment to this place, to Vancouver and the West Coast, also to her language, her use of language as a building block and form, and also how she uses everyday actions in her performative choreography. The title, I feel like, is a very rich title. Only when I'm hauling water do I wonder if I'm getting any stronger. And it references Carol's own writing, specifically a book she published in 1982, Whistle, Daughter, Whistle, which we've adapted slightly for the title. And this writing is concerned with the labors of the artist, women's labor, and laborers of off-grid living on the West Coast. Some of the works that we've seen that we are showing here in the exhibition have been seen in other exhibitions, including the figure rattle, which is the singular rattle hanging in the far room, Carol's first that's been shown at the Belkin. A Bösendorfer for Al Neal is in the Vags collection, and it's been shown there several times, as well as at the Art Gallery of Alberta. Fish Film, which is the film being projected here, was shown as part of an installation performance at the Grant. And a sculptural aspect of the inlet, which is in this long floor work here, was shown as part of a presentation at SFU Galleries earlier this year. This exhibition does include several new works, such as the inlet installation and Carol's costumes from her performance at the opening on September 7th, a costume that continues her interest in inhabiting the body of chickens, geese, and in this case, a kind of undetermined grouse come seagull. So she hasn't quite articulated what that is yet. So alongside the presentation of her work in solo projects, Carol's work has also been included in important historical shows. The first being the traveling show WAC, Art in the Feminist Revolution, 1965 to 80, which was shown at the VAG in 2008. And included some local artists. Dinah, I'm sure we'll talk more about that. The second being Traffic, Conceptual Art in Canada, 1965 to 80, which toured across Canada and also showed at the Vancouver Art Gallery in 2012. And the third being Radial Change, Move to Recenter in 2018 as part of Beginning with the 70s at the Belkin, an examination of art practices and social justice movements that was curated by Lorna Brown. So I think social change is really at the core of these three shows and is a starting point for understanding Carol's practice within a history of conceptual work, fluxus, and expanding notions of artistic genres or art's increasing interdisciplinarity at a certain moment in time. Carol was a participant in the Artist Run Center Intermedia, which started in 1967 as a place where artists, architects, engineers, academics, musicians, and others could explore new technologies and timely issues. And her work has also been presented at the Western Front on several occasions. The first time her rattles were shown was there, also curated by Dinah, as well as her presentation of readings and other performances. So interwoven into Carol's work are feminist, ecological, equity, and community concerns. Her interest in where women are positioned in social structures is apparent in her 1967 motorcycle performance, her 1971 raw egg costume, which is photographed by Tacky Blues singer and is blown up in the Kerner Library at this moment, her 1975 performance tribute to chickens, and her critique of consumerism, fronting an ethos of reuse, handwork, domestic labor, and ecological stewardship. And all of these things sort of support an understanding of a social and environmental ecology that takes up the politics of land use and human support of the more than human. And for me, her tenacity, her humor, her patience, her maximalism, her language, and her exhaustive physical and material considerations make hers a practice to return to again and again. So part of the thinking here is to think about how Carol's work has been framed in the past by curators, writers, and institutions, and where this framing could be expanded. The hope is that this curatorial conversation could draw out some of the long view aspects of Carol's practice, and then also to think about what aspects need better contextualization within the histories of Canadian art and international art from this shared curatorial perspective. So thank you very much to the panelists, Glenn Alteen, Dinah Ogaitis, and Kimberly Phillips. Unfortunately, Lorna Brown could not be with us today. And thank you to them for taking part in sharing their curatorial perspectives. I'm really grateful that you're here. So introductions, and you are in the right order, I like that, alphabetically. Glenn Alteen is a Vancouver-based curator, writer, and founding program director of The Grunt from 1984 to 2020, where he showed Carol's work in exhibition and performance contexts. He is co-founder of Live Performance Biennial and the Blue Cabin Residency. In 2018, he was awarded the Governor General's Award in Visual and Media Art for Outstanding Contribution to Contemporary Practices. Dinah Ogaitis was Chief Curator, Associate Director from 1996 to 2019 at the Vancouver Art Gallery and Interim Director there from 2019 to 2020, where Carol's work has been included in several exhibitions and is also held in the collection. Before that, she was the Director of Visual Arts Program at Banff, held curatorial positions at the Walter Phillips Gallery, the Western Front, Convertible Showroom, and Franklin Furnace. She is a recipient very recently of the Alvin Balkin Curators Prize, the Natician Foundation Award for Curatorial Excellence, the Canadian Museums Association Award for Outstanding Achievement in Research, and the Emily Award from Emily Carr Institute of Art and Design. And Kimberly Phillips is the director curator of SFU Galleries at Simon Fraser University, where she recently presented Carol's film, Please Meet the Geese Who Have Lived Here Forever. SFU Galleries collection also holds Carol's work. Previously, Kimberly was the curator at the Contemporary Art Gallery and director curator of Access. She holds a PhD from UBC, where she was an Isaac Walton Killam Doctoral Fellow. So I've asked each of you to describe the history of your connection to Carol's work, what projects they've curated and why. And I thought I would just quickly say how I came to Carol's work, aside from seeing it in and around Vancouver for many years. But I began, the first time I worked with Carol was part of an exhibition at SFU Gallery entitled Geometry of Knowing in 2015. And the show was multi-part and trying to think through, it was a moment where we were trying to reassess ways of knowing that language in a university context. And so thinking about knowledge in that full mind, body, spirit way of intelligence. And we were thinking about artists that used field work and body and embodiment and materiality in processes that revealed ways of knowing. So we included her photograph, Euclid's 13th Theorem, from a 1979 series, as well as Al Neal's LP Boot and Fog, which uses one of Carroll's Euclid photographs on the cover. And this photograph was produced in collaboration with Al Neal, and he is doing a performance where he's drawing Euclidean geometry on the sand and the beach in Kate's Park. And so that seemed to be a way of thinking with Carroll. She did a public program with us and started talking through this process. And from there, I became very intrigued in her ways of working. So I'd like to start with Dinah, who I think has the most enduring, in terms of time, relationship to Carroll's work. And then we'll go to Glenn and then Kimberly. So thanks, Dinah.
Thank you, Melanie, and thank you, everybody, for being here. And congratulations on this show. It's really great that Carroll's archive is here and that you really have taken the time to dig into it and bring it to a broader public. My first connection with Carroll happened when Hank Bull went on sabbatical at the Western Front Gallery, and I stood in for him. And I had just finished the curatorial program at Emily Carr, and I was about to do my first studio visit to Al Neal, because that was the one show that Hank had booked, and the show was opening in like weeks. So I had to hustle down and figure out what that was going to be all about. So I called Carroll to find out how to get to the Dollarton Mud Flats to visit with Al, and she was very clear in her communication and very informative and gave me some tips on how to approach it. So I parked the car, I found the path through the woods, and as I approached the blue cabin down by the water, I was really taken with the color of the cabin, the fact that it was on this interstitial space between the water and the land. And as I took a moment to look around a little bit, I noticed that there were piles of things that were maybe hanging in the forest and other things that were in front of the house. And in hindsight, of course, these things did have a meaning to them. They weren't just randomly dropped, disused items. They had some kind of power to them. So in hindsight, this would have been my first viewing of Carroll's work, rather unwittingly. But a few months later, I think again on Hank's recommendation, I did a studio visit with Carroll and was absolutely amazed by what she had in her attic apartment, or attic studio, I should say. And we proceeded to organize an exhibition at the Western Front. So that was 1984, and I think it was the first show of the Rattles that happened there, and the title of the show was Rattles, and I see that name has absolutely stuck to this body of assemblage. I left Vancouver a few years later, went to Banff, came back a decade later, but while I was away, that's when she had all of her larger exhibitions at the Surrey Art Gallery that you can see on the left, or where the streets are paved with gold. That was a very large installation at the Vancouver Art Gallery. So I'm missing all of those things in person, but when I came back as the chief curator at the Vancouver Art Gallery in 1996, I was delighted to go down to the vault, and hanging on the back wall was the grand piano, a Bösendorfer for Al Neal, her biggest rattle. So it was just wonderful to see that there as an iconic work. And I went into the files, the object files, to find out more about it. And the justification had been written by Scott Watson, who was the curator in 1986 when the work was acquired, when it was purchased. And he had made a rationale that he wanted to be more representative of the people working in collage and assemblage around people like Al Neal, the collection was didn't have very much of. And I suspect that Joan Richardson might have been the one who actually put it forward, because Joan was the one that a few years later did actually curate Where the Ground is Paved with Gold, and facilitated David Rimmer doing that film piece on that project. I also found a note in that file from Ian Tom, who was then the registrar, and it was a memo to the curators, and it said, "It is my strongest recommendation that the public no longer be allowed to touch these objects. Of course, Carol had intended them to be rattles and for people to shake them and for people to make noise and have a cacophony going with them. But Ian made it quite clear that the work would not last. It would simply disintegrate if that were to continue. I also noticed that in its more recent presentations, there used to be a theatrical light on the floor in front of it that she had also designed with found objects. And I think that that harkens to her theatrical interest from a very early age and also wanting to have a very strong light on it that produced dark shadows on the back. So I suspect that somewhere along the way, the cables, somebody tripped on cables, and that was the end of the theatrical light in front of the piece. So that was at the Vancouver Art Gallery, I guess a few years later, when we were negotiating with the Museum of Contemporary Art to show WAC Art and the Feminist Revolution, 1965 to 1980, I spoke with the curator, Connie Butler, and asked her whether she would mind if we augmented the exhibition when it was presented in Vancouver and added the work of a dozen Canadian artists. So many of them were from Vancouver, but there was also Joyce Whelan, Vera Frankel, Susie Lake from other parts of Canada, Betty Goodwin. And of course, Carol's work fit in quite squarely into the section that was on assemblage and pattern. And in those days, it wasn't that less is more, it was that more is more. And Carol's work was, I think, really spot on in how it validated a new kind of material that comes from the domestic realm as artwork. If you think at the time, it was a moment for conceptual artists to be working, for minimalists to be working, where the prevailing aesthetic was very clean and minimal. So I think that she and many other groups and feminists among them were really going against the grain to make some different kind of statements. So that work, I think, had not only aesthetic powers in that exhibition, but the fact that it came from a feminist perspective was also really important. And as Melanie mentioned, in addition to that, the fact that Carol was doing a critique of consumerism, but even in the 70s and 80s, it's nothing compared to what it is now, but already at that point, the marketing machine and mass media were really taking off, and she was really feeling the effects and the pressures of that kind of mass advertising. But she also wore her interests in the environment and environmentalism on her sleeve, and always lived the values of not buying things and not being a consumer unless you absolutely had to be. So I think all of those things were additionally important to her work, besides the fact of being a feminist at the core. The next moment when I exhibited her work, it was an exhibition between object and action. I was interested in a few performance artists who were based in Vancouver, Kathy Falk, Evelyn Roth, Kate Craig, and how their actions and their performances somehow were manifest later on in objects and other physical iterations. So Carol was in the same gallery as Kate Craig, aka Lady Brute, and I had known about Carol's log piece from my days at the Western Front when people would talk about it. That was one of my great educations, was working at the Western Front for those few years that I did. But diving into her performance pieces, it became clear that she also had a persona, the motorcycle maven. And she was the second woman in Vancouver to own a motorcycle and made a point of dressing as femininely as she could and wearing as much makeup as she could when she went out on a bike. She talked about a time when she went out on wearing her bikini, but then thought better of it, thinking maybe that wasn't such a safe thing to do. Anyway, that was another moment to go into some of the archival materials that she has and to consider them. And one of the results of that was that she did donate one of the chicken boxes to the Vancouver Art Gallery collection, which I think needed to be more robust in representing the breadth of her career. And the last one that I'll just mention very briefly, because you'll probably talk more about it, Glenn, was an exhibition largely based on some new works that had come into the collection called The Poetics of Space. And it had a number of artists in it who were thinking about space, whether it was domestic space or other kinds of space, in a number of different ways. And Emmy Lee Wall and I worked on that. And that was a chance for us to show The Pink Room, which was a massive project that Carol had done. And it had come into the collection. And I always thought that it was important, especially for the larger pieces and installations, to somehow be grounded and contextualized within the collection. So I'll stop there at a very halt. I'll just halt.
Thank you. So Glenn, over to you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Thank you. I first saw Carol's work at those exhibitions, that exhibition you curated at the Western Front was very, and subsequent exhibitions at the Western Front. And I was the Rattles, and I was always impressed on how much they evoked the West Coast and the rainforest. They just seemed to feel it. But later in 2000, Carol brought to Grunt the Pink Room installation, dealing with her daughter's struggle with childhood sexual abuse, mental health issues, and finally suicide. It was a very heavy exhibition. The installation was a portrait of Laura, using many of her clothes and belongings, her psychiatric assessments, sewing them into quilts, as well as her school report cards and awards, journal entries, etc. It was deeply personal and deeply moving. There were tears shed throughout the exhibition daily. It was an intense work, painful to make for Carol and painful to inhabit for the viewer. Laura stood in for many women dealing with sexual abuse issues during the period, and one of the only exhibitions that directly addressed the issue. There was something essentially Carol about the installation. As much as it was a portrait of Laura, it was also a story of Carol's own journey through the grief and the loss of Laura's passing. It was an evocation of the feminine... Yeah. What? Lara. It was an evocation of the feminist maxim, the personal is political, in a profound way. I don't know what else to say. I was so great when you guys took it in the end. It's in the collection at the Vancouver Art Gallery, and it's kind of different than any other piece of work that you did. It's very singular. It kind of stands on its own. It doesn't really speak to any of the other work in her collection, I don't think. But then after that, I worked on the Al Neal project that we had put together, and I got to know Carol quite a bit through that. And then she brought us a second project, which was the Fishville, which was an installation of this and a performance around this piece that she'd done. The installation around what was... she collaborated with Bo Myers. The exhibition celebrated the inlet that her and her partner Al Neal inhabited in the Blue Cabin. The project uses the flotsam and jetsam of the foreshore, referencing the pollution of the inlet and harking back to Carol's themes of environmental destruction, planned obsolescence, and recycling. But her use of silvery fabrics that evoke sunshine on the water and the different saved detritus to stand in for different shellfish and animals that were a big part of the foreshore. The project was in the beginning of a string of projects that focused on the inlet. And indeed, that's been the main focus of her work ever since. Much of it is in this exhibition. The installation in the adjacent room, of course, of the geese and the geese costume that were part of the Please Meet the Geese Who Have Lived Here Forever, have a sense of whimsy despite the serious themes and intents. And this dichotomy is always at the heart of Carol's work. While she has stayed relevant to the ecological, the feminist, the social, and the political concerns of the time, she's done it in a way that's fresh and humorous. I came closer to Carol and Carol and Al over the past 15 years, and through the Blue Cabin Project, have worked closely with her in preserving and expanding their legacy. Like the Rattles, this project has the same specificity of the, to the West Coast, and it speaks directly to the history and geography of this place. It, her strong sense of place seems to follow her everywhere. And yeah, so thank you.
Thanks, Glenn. So, Kimberly.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having us here, Melanie. And so I'm honored to be on Musqueam territory. I think of the group, I guess I'm the longtime listener, first time caller. So I've worked with Carol most recently and only once in a formal capacity, but I remember the very first time I encountered her work, which was probably at the Vancouver Art Gallery watching Bösendorfer for Al Neal get installed. Which, similar, Glenn, to, as you said, it has such a, it's an incredible work, and it left such a mark on me, especially when thinking about this place, this region, and the kind of, as Jim Bomford once told me, like the West Coast has a way of, it's like the bathtub rings around your bathtub. It has a way of gathering things, and things wash up here and accumulate. And I've always felt that her assemblages sort of speak to some of that. My desire to work with Carol began quite a long ways back, sort of waiting for the right moment. And when I arrived at SFU Galleries, which, as some of you may know, has actually currently three galleries operating, two at the downtown campus and one up on Burnaby Mountain. And even though I knew that the SFU Art Collection held Carol's work in the collection, and historically often collection-based exhibitions are based up on the mountain, and then the O'Dayne Gallery downtown, is because it has such a close relationship with the School for Contemporary Arts, is often where works by international artists, you know, in the sort of middle point of their careers is shown. So I actually felt quite strongly that I wanted to show her work at the O'Dayne Gallery downtown, thinking specifically about the audience community of the interdisciplinary art students who are in that building in the Goldcorp Center, and how important it felt for me to show Carol's work and the vitality of it as a senior artist, and the long path of her, like long trajectory of her practice, and the significance, the urgencies of her practice, of her inquiry, which are still very present today, and you know, we're still grappling with many of these issues around you know, her concerns with ecological crises and extinction, questions around women identifying laborers, etc. So it felt really important to show her work in that context. I was also teaching, I was slated to teach a course on the history of modern art in the term that Carol's show would open. And I hadn't taught that course in a long while. And I was like, God, how do I approach the history of modern art? Like, feels like a really complicated thing to do. So I tried to recast the seminar in more of like bringing artists into whose own work grapples with the legacies of modernism in different ways. And the class basically spent the whole time in Carol's show because so much of her work kind of calls up and pushes against kind of presumptions and rhetoric around the narrative of modernist art. So I was really excited for them to kind of witness her working and her work in the context of this place within a kind of larger conversation of you know, Western modern art over the last kind of century and a half or so. So I also was really keen to have the audience communities, you know, in Vancouver, but more particularly the students, encounter her practice because of the ways that she lives her work and the decisions she makes always to call in others. She has such an incredible way of thinking about kinship. And one of the reasons why we decided to show Please Meet the Geese Who've Lived Here Forever is you know, it's a meditation on how to be a community. And lots of times I'm in conversations with younger artists who are, you know, working really hard and struggling to figure out how do you get things done and how do you make work in a really tough city and there's no funds to do it, or it seems impossible. And it was really incredibly buoying to have Carol to be able to point to her work as, you know, a woman making art, you know, with what you have around you. And when you don't feel you have something, you find it and you build it yourself. And often that means calling others into your work and lifting others up. And something that you notice in the exhibition, the ways that she's always lifting others up alongside her as authors of her work. So I felt that was a really significant thing to show, you know, younger developing artists that, you know, this, you can do it, and it's been happening this way for such a long while. One of the other things that felt really important, and something I identified with Carol very early on in our conversations, was the way she's always considered children as a really important audience community for her work. And not just an audience community, but often the very first critics and kind of individuals for feedback while she's developing work. And at her home and studio in Maldon in Strathcona, she would describe how when she was, you know, working through a body of work, she would present it in the courtyard to the kids who lived in the co-op and, you know, brace herself for the feedback. Because kids have this incredible way of being super blunt and amazingly honest and really serious about play, right? And she totally understands what it means to play and what it means to listen and what we can kind of, how we can remind ourselves of how we can be by watching children and listening to them and putting them kind of at the center of conversation. So, and I feel Please Meet the Geese Who've Lived Here Forever as a film and the amazing properties that are a part of it, which we showed in the gallery as sort of semi-sculptural objects, have a real childlike quality to them. And the kind of willful awkwardness of a lot of her assemblage work, her performance, her costumes, is again, a real strategy to push back against a sort of slickness and a kind of presumptions around value that we kind of slide into often in our communities. And kind of selfishly speaking, SFU Galleries hasn't really had a history of working, of thinking about children as an audience community. And we're building a brand new art museum on the Burnaby Mountain as we speak. And the mandate of that art museum will expand to include kids and families and youth of all ages. And I was keen to talk with Carol about that and thought that this was a really interesting moment to experiment with, like, how do we listen to kids and, like, welcome them into the space of the gallery? So it was the first project that we actually did kid-specific programming. Kids were very much a part of the opening performance the opening reception to the show. And we also made, we wanted to do an artist book of some sort, but Carol was really adamant that we make a coloring book out of the storyboards that she built to kind of build her film. So the book, tracks the film, and in the center of it, it's pretty awesome. There's a the kind of pivotal moment in the film where the enormous silent ship goes through the frame. So we have like a kinetic element to the book. So it was a beautiful kind of labor of love to create this, and you can imagine the number of conversations around the weight of the paper, and it had to be paper that was like heavy enough that markers wouldn't go through because kids like working with markers. So she was so specific and so attentive, which was such an incredible thing to watch. And it was really amazing to have students and my staff team also kind of be witness to the care that she brought to how young people are actually engaging with the work, not only just as audiences, but also as like the stewards like of this world for the next generation. So I think she doesn't separate any of those things, like her responsibility as an artist, responsibility as a human, as a woman in the community. And I really, it was inspiring to kind of watch that and be a part of it.
Thanks. And also, yes, Kimberly and I have been talking about this is the year of Carol. So Carol's most recent work was shown starting last January, and then we're, you know, closing out the year with the show. So thanks for that, Carol. So I want to try and pose some questions that maybe are generative to a conversation between all of us. And I'm just thinking about the questions that I've written and what order makes sense. But I think just back to Kimberly, you sort of talking about Carol's, you know, interest in kinship, the way that she lives her work. I think that one of my questions is, you know, how Carol's practice takes up social and ecological choreography, how she works with collaboration in mind, but also holds on to the singular authorship, so how she kind of balances these things. And of course, key to this are both the people and the sites and kind of mutual respect for the site of Kate's Park, the site of Strathcona and its inhabitants, the site of, Roberts Creek, Babyland. And as Dinah said, you know, these are sites where, and when you went to the Blue Cabin, that are, you know, sites where on the shore, where the land meets the water and where activities are taking place in those sites. So I was thinking about a question that could try and tease out some of the mechanisms of choreography, like the designing of choreographic sequences, the way that she takes up choreography in her practice. And I'm glad she's not here because she did share with me a list of influences, which I'm going to trot out a little bit today to help spur the conversation. So she gave me a long list of influences of people who have been important to her practice. And in relationship to choreography, I think that she's certainly thinking about aspects of dance and theater, but much beyond that. So I'm just going to list some, this is not definitive, individuals that she has mentioned to me. So Yvonne Rainer, Merce Cunningham, Robert Lepage, Crystal Pite, Lady Gaga, and Laurie Anderson. And so I'm just thinking a little bit about how Carol takes up some of those ideas of theatricality, of choreography, and brings them into her own practice. And I wondered if people have thoughts about that. Okay, and if you don't, that's fine.
One of the things that strikes me is how much her studying theater design in the early 60s shows up in different ways in her work, the way she lit the rattles, the way in different ways that those things play out. And it's funny because it's they don't come off as being theatrical or theater in any way. They come off in a whole other way, but they really... It's really an influence of what, how she used that education and where she uses it in her work, mm-hmm. I think is fascinating.
Glenn, when we were preparing her exhibition materials, she was adamant that when we wrote her bio out, that we add in a phrase that spoke about her work in a scene shop in Vancouver while she was to fund her way through school.
Yeah.
As the singular most important point to put into the bio, actually. And I thought it spoke a lot about the influence of that time and working in a theatrical setting, but also for me the way that she refuses to kind of make distinctions or silos between some of these elements of materiality and genre that or media that she's working in, that a performance, that a property from a film is also a sculptural element or an assemblage or an installation, or you know, these things are just really fluid for her. So that's something that really struck me.
I also think about, the progression of her career. And as a young artist, she talked about, I think it was maybe in the interview with Lorna, she talked about being at the table when Intermedia was formed, but really she was a product of it. And I think what she talked about was, you know, being a dancer as a female, as a young, thin, beautiful female for other people's performances, and then maybe coming into her own as the main choreographer of her performances. But I think it was a time, like I also think about Kate Craig, and she was the one that actually painted most of the color bars, even though the color bars are attributed elsewhere. But there was a role that some of the women played in relationship to some of the performances and artworks that were being produced. That maybe wasn't frontline and wasn't acknowledged, but then coming into their own and just gaining more confidence as women and as practitioners, taking more control over the decisions that were made and how things were framed and how they were put forward.
Mm-hmm. I'm also thinking about, you know, definitions of choreography and like imagining, what does the choreographer do? It's like positioning like bodies and ideas in space, right? And so there's a certain amount of plotting and preparation and scoring that happens, but then also ultimately there has to be an element of like things that unfold in the real, and there's things that happen that are not in the control of the choreographer always, right? So there's something about that with Carol's work too that feels very like she understands how that works and is super embracing of of all of those elements of chance that can that unfold.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there is the elements of literal performance, but also the performative nature of the way the rattles were meant to be interacted with, the way that, in fact, that light still does exist for the Bösendorfer for Al Neal, and we decided not to use it because it wouldn't work with the kind of idea that Carol had had to make a forest of rattles. So to make something that you had to bodily move around and engage with in a specific way, despite the fact that these are now museological pieces and you cannot touch them. But the same way that, you know, the inlet is meant to be an experiential situation in which the audience member is being given a score to move around in a way. But I also think about the way that she performs for the camera and say the tarpaulin pull that's outside on the exterior screen, you know, sort of engaging with the gestures of the everyday, rowing her rowboat, knitting together, I should say stitching together old tarps that are being collected for disposal. I mean, this is all part of a kind of daily action, but that has been sort of heightened into a choreography for the camera. And so I feel like there's a kind of a presentness, as you've articulated with, you know, thinking through the essentials of audience in terms of children, but the essentials of kind of a viewership of us engaging with that that lived experience.
It's also with that, with costumes too, which is the other part of it, and how she uses costumes and just watching her get ready for this performance. And that, that costume was really important to her. And you know, she spent a lot of time making sure that was ready and, you know, she really fretted over it. And it's amazing. I mean, it is the most amazing thing when you saw that procession was this costume is incredible. And yeah, and that detail just, I mean, it's been great to kind of watch him. And you know, I was lucky enough to get to the cabin a few times before it got and spend some time there and see the work that they, because Carol and Al made these assemblages that were not really meant for anybody else. They were just kind of meant for them. And so not many people made it to the cabin. Like they didn't invite a lot of people out there. And because I think they felt fairly vulnerable in terms of this thing, because they really knew they could get kicked out at any minute. So there was they kept it to themselves. I mean, that was what made trying to save the Blue Cabin difficult, because as soon as we started to draw attention to it, all of a sudden people started going there and it became vulnerable because of that, you know, and they were very conscious of that all the way through, not letting people know it's there and not inviting that many people out to it.
I love that her list of influences is so broad and international and contemporary as well as historical. And I think that we're often, just because we're so isolated here on the West Coast, we're often trying to define everything very specifically and locally. And that makes sense. But I think it's also important with her work to recognize that she studied in Rome, that she traveled after that and spent time in Paris and in London. She would go to New York and see things there. She saw the Merce Cunningham. Well, she would have participated at UBC in all of those performances that the festivals that would happen on an annual basis. She did see Merce Cunningham and Robert Rauschenberg. Pardon me. In 1970. So I think it is important also to think of that whole lineage, as you were saying, of Western art, Western modernist art, and where she fits in when you start with Braque and Picasso and go to the Surrealists and Duchamp's ready-mades, and then Louise Nevelson comes along and Carol's right there doing things that are very similar. So I think it's useful to also expand an analysis of a practice into the larger world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. I mean, she also, having met Yvonne Rainer and Robert Rauschenberg and Merce Cunningham here, slept in Yvonne Rainer's loft and witnessed, you know, rehearsals and things happening there in New York. So we are screening Carol's films and Yvonne Rainer's the Private Lives of Performers on November 2nd at the Cinematheque as a way to start teasing that relationship out. Okay, so now you've given me a good in for my next question, which is just thinking about places that Carol's practice needs better contextualization within the histories of Canadian and international art. And for example, visual poetry is one of those places where Carol's work as a visual poet has been acknowledged in a recent publication by Gregory Betts on avant-garde poetry scene in Vancouver in 1959-79, where her colleagues were Judith Copperthorne and others. And so just thinking about the relationship between art and writing in Vancouver, but also repositioning Carol and Judith as taking up visual poetry, maybe as opposed to concrete poetry, sticking to the hand drawn, the hand hewn, a kind of feminist, as Dinah said earlier, kind of resistance, a kind of resistance to some of the other aesthetic and material qualities. I think that was an exciting, whether or not we agree so much with that particular piece of scholarship, Gregory Betts scholarship, it's exciting to see Carol included in that text. So she also then, of course, wrote throughout her practice. And when she published Whistle, Daughter, Whistle, it was a prose text that was much more journalistic or diaristic, more intimate. And I think that kind of writing continued throughout her life. Now, she also names a number of writers as influences. So I'll list them. Gertrude Stein, Leonard Cohen, Roy Kiyoka, Robert Duncan, Jack Spicer, Phyllis Webb, Alice Munro, Margaret Lawrence, Maria Campbell, and Thompson Highway. So that leads me just to ask, I think, all of you, what other aspects of Carol's practice do you see needing deeper contextualization? I mean, Dinah, you've already mentioned Louise Nevelson, and, you know, I'm thinking about Louise Bourgeois is listed as one of Carol's influences. Louise Nevelson is not, but I feel like that's a pretty interesting comparison to make in terms of lifespan and assemblage and the collection of materials. But certainly, you know, Louise Bourgeois's you know, personal narrative, her large-scale work, her way of thinking about domesticity and family and sexuality in the body, kind of the trauma, the unconscious, they all have a lot, I think, to say to Carol's practice. So my question to you, Yaz, is what could use better contextualization, in your opinion, in Carol's work? What are the gaps, maybe? Seeing that she's been, you know, well articulated within a history of Canadian conceptual art, partially contextualized within a history of feminist practice.
It's such a wide-ranging practice. That's the thing about Carol, is it's, she's doing so many things and how she works with that. Like, it's, you know, and earlier quite talking about, you know, her working with filmmakers and how, you know, she works with these younger filmmakers, but they're making her work. Like, they're not, it's really interesting how she collaborates and works in that context.
Yeah, I was going to say, along those lines, I mean, so she's worked very closely with Alison Hrablic, among others, and I would love to see, it'd be lovely to tease out a much more nuanced kind of set of threads of film practice in this city coming out of a particular moment, and how Carol's woven in through that in different ways, kind of coming into context, and also with sound artists as well, even more recently. So that would be interesting to see. I was also thinking, like, thinking forward, and you're mentioning like her work in terms of choreographies of the everyday and everyday actions, bringing presence to them, like in terms of a feminist practice. But there's a lot of other really interesting dance artists that are working in this way as well. I'm thinking specifically of Justine Chambers, and whether or not Justine would mark Carol as an influence. Like, there's interesting sets of there's weird lineages that are maybe, it would be useful to kind of see if we could just tease out, like, what would surface if we thought a little bit harder about where some of those impetuses come from and why did they develop, when they did and where they did, and so that kind of thing.
On November 2nd at the Cinematheque, Carol will be in conversation with Justine Chambers.
Oh, great.
I think it's equally important not only to continue the contextualization that both of you are doing and others, but also to get it out there in the world. I know that the World Wide Web is one platform, but it feels like the physicality of the work also needs to get pushed out there. Like, for whatever reason, Carol's work hasn't been shown a great deal beyond this province, and I think it would be great to ship it eastward.
That's a good point.
Definitely.
Okay, and then I have my last question, and then feel free to, you know, bring in anything else that is of interest to you. But my last question is, of course, about the kind of urgency of the climate crisis, and how Carol's work feels at this particular time, especially this, you know, past week of growing political instability. And so the way Carol's work kind of situates itself between a West Coast kind of back to the land 1970s bucket, and also a kind of apocalyptic sensibility. And so I hadn't really thought about this too much until the exhibition opened and I was speaking with many of the wonderful young people that work here. And there's a real Mad Max quality to some of her work, including the Fish film and the motorcycle Maven. This kind of, and for Mad Max, of those of you who don't know it, it's a post-apocalyptic, you know, dystopian film series out of Australia that began in 1979. So the timing is interesting for there, but it's depicting a kind of future experiencing societal collapse and ecocide. So you spoke about Carol's silvery metallic costume, you know, playing with the idea of light on the water, fish scales, et cetera. But there is another reading of that is sort of a kind of a future kind of dystopian kind of costume as well. And I think that sensibility is really resonating with viewers because of our own anxieties, and that Carol actually offers something as a way of living that maintains a kind of respect and lightness on the land, a kind of living in between spaces, living in co-ops or living in, you know, the blue cabin, that offers this potential of still a path forward. And I'm wondering if you have thoughts on that. I mean, I think especially maybe with the geese.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the first thing that I would say is back to that word kinship and the ways in which Carol's work and her life really kind of decentering the human experience as the one that is most informed about how to move forward and like what we can learn from other species and how we might be wise to kind of listen and be attentive to the ways in which other species have lived, other communities have lived. So that sort of extra kinship, like the kinship that goes beyond human to human. And again, it has something to do for me with going back to her understanding of the seriousness of play, of like, you know, when kids imagine themselves in a particular role or they build worlds, it's super serious. And it's also very possible. It's as possible as you want to make it. So this quality I find often with her work that really understands that, and that like we are the limiting factors in the way we want to move forward in the world. And yeah, there's this sense of foreboding, I think, definitely, but there's also the sense of possibility if we only pay better attention to what's close at hand to us. So
there's a profound love of objects in Carol and in her work. I mean, she really loves that. You know, these certain things really resonate for her, whether it's the silvery fabric on fish film or the rattles of big wooden pieces of rattles. Like, it's kind of a funny recycle, because there's this very big recycle thing is a really big part of it. And part of it's environmental, but I think part of it is just she enjoys that. That's a real big part of her. You know, going to Sally Ann's a good afternoon for her. She enjoys that process. And I think that way she uses objects, the love of the object is really in the way she uses them, and you can really sense it as you see these things. Mm-hmm. You know, watching each of these geese get performed, like the last one, the one with the big wing, like it's been amazing watching these, and they're so, it's such a crazy thing, you know, take a bunch of duck decoys and try to turn them into geese.
Masquerading as geese.
Yeah, yeah.
They live in her home / studio. They live swaddled in blankets in their own baskets as well. Like, she, you know, they're not stored in boxes, you know, in a, they're in her world, even when they're not on display.
And just watching her in that process, like watching her make work, and you really don't, you're watching it, but you really don't know what she's doing. Like, I mean, as much as you kind of, she kind of tells you a few things, it's still a complete mystery because you kind of, it's the way, it, you know, the way it turns out in the end is not what you might have expected as you were watching it coming into being.
Mm-hmm. I feel like the work itself, I agree with you that her, the values that she lives, are very significant, but the work itself for me is about a kind of consciousness raising, whether it's the collages, it gives you a more heightened sense of what the forest or what the water is like, or a greater consciousness of one's relationship to the water. But I would say that the younger generation of artists is maybe more action-oriented in terms of actually doing something that will make a concrete difference. Not that this doesn't have a concrete effect in our minds, which then the consciousness leads to all of us acting somehow. So it obviously does contribute in important ways, but in the mind, not through action.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just corroborate that in that working with her, you know, we were thinking a lot about the water, thinking a lot about the expertise of looking at water and trying to represent or find material, metallic fabric, reflective materials that would help her be able to articulate this experience and this elusive experience of seeing water sparkle at a distance that when you paddle out to it disappears. And so Carol and I did spend time together looking at the ocean. Like, that's part of what the work demands that you do, is taking the looking that you do here back out into the world. And so there are certain projects that Carol's talked about, like Bilateral Bend, which we are not showing any of here, a project that wasn't fully realized, but that reflection that you see in the water of the landscape behind, and that mirroring where the world does something perceptually so interesting that the water and landscape enable a particular way of looking. And so this kind of elusive experience that the work is trying to find articulation then demands that you go out and have this kind of slower attention to the world around you. Or the geese. I've spent a lot more time looking at the social structures of flocks of geese because of Carol's work. And so I think that is that kind of that returned attention is part of maybe the little bit of the action as well. Thank you, everybody, for your thoughts. And I would like to open it up if anybody has any questions or comments from the audience. Ian.
Can I say something? Yes, thank you to our panel here for your incredible insights and experience with Carol's work. As I heard your comments coming up, some of my first questions that were coming to my mind of special interest to me, in your comments, you've sort of covered some of my queries. But there's two points of interest from my point of view anyways that is central and key to how I understand her work, and not just her work, but other artists associated with where she was coming from and the period she was coming from. The key one is what we used to call outsider art, you know, because in the 50s and the 60s, Al was a bit older, so that brings him in. I first saw him on TV playing jazz at the Cellar in the 1950s in a documentary on CBC. In any case, so that goes back to then. But and by the 60s, this rejection of middle class culture that was began to, the artists of the period, or not all artists, but some artists of the period, of which Al Neal was a classic, and Carol being attracted to Al and living with him as an outsider in the Blue Cabin, was a kind of a rejection of this kind of middle-class bourgeois lifestyle that was surfacing, and I don't diss it because I'm a part of it, in the 60s and on. But their position as what I call outsider artists, this anarchistic attitude that it was in the work and their separation from things. But what we have to be aware of as we kind of begin to learn from that work and absorb it into our institutional culture of the new millennium is not to accept it too easily. You know, what we want to do is create a discourse around the work that allows it to be understood, to be liked, to be learned from, etc., all of which is great. But let's also acknowledge the outsiderism that exists in this work. In other words, the parts of the work that we cannot and should not completely absorb from a institutionalizing middle class point of view. And, you know, I'm probably exaggerating that a little bit too much. But this is something that, for instance, of the artists of the period from which Carol comes from, was really, really important. And I think that's what gives her work its originality, you know, where she stood separate from everything. Also, what in a, the other side of her work, too, that makes it understandable is that I see her as a landscape artist. You know, she works with the landscape, and she was living in the landscape as a survivor, as a squatter on the mudflats in the Cates Park. And there was a culture out there, as we know, the mudflat squatter scene, beginning with Malcolm Lowry in the 1940s. Everybody forgets that Malcolm Lowry wrote Under the Volcano, just a few hundred yards down the beach from where Al Neal and Carol lived in the Blue Cabin. And then, of course, through the in this. So I am going through a little bit of well-known art history here of Vancouver in the 60s, 70s, and on and on and on. But Carol's work really comes out of it, and it's what a fantastic exhibition this is. I really celebrate the fact that we can bring this work out of the woods and into the gallery here so we can learn from it and experience it and adore it. Thank you for all the work you guys have done. That's enough for me. Thank you.
Thanks, Ian. Yeah, I mean, I think Carol's an interesting example of someone who is, I wouldn't use the term outsider artist because certainly she went to UBC and Vancouver School of Art and, you know, studied theater in Italy. But I think that that ethos, and Al being a different case, right? Mm-hmm. That ethos is one, as you say, not to be dismissed or absorbed too readily. But also you think about where she was situating herself in terms of showing at the Western Front and Intermedia, those early days. So yeah, absolutely.
I would even say I remember not a discomfort, but a sort of wariness maybe about like presenting work in a gallery context, even though she'd done it many, many, many times over the course of her long, long practice, and a sort of pushing against presumed ways of working in the gallery. So as an example, you know, our preparators, we'd be working to hang her quilts on the back wall of the gallery, and you know, the preps are working to ensure that they had appropriate hardware. And she was like, I just picked these up at the dollar store. It's going to be great. Like, we can totally work with these. And my preparator is kind of like, okay, no, we'll do the appropriate thing. But it's a fascinating, like, this will be just as good. Like, why does it matter what this hardware looks like? And I was fascinated to kind of observe the interaction and how really it's a pushback against a set of, again, like a set of presumptions around value, and a kind of like a kind of sanitization, and a kind of way in which we presume to behave and how things change when they move into this space, right? Like, so I kind of take your comments in that way, Ian, as well, which is important, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, and she emerges at a time when artists on centers are just getting going. She's part of creating them. And it's really a moment of artists determining their lives and their exhibition opportunities for themselves. Like, there was, yes, maybe I was the curator of the show, but she didn't really need a curator. She she was ready, prepared. She knew what she wanted to do. She needed somebody to unlock the door and do the press release for it and make sure that people came and saw the work. So
I painted the wall. I think was, yeah, no, I mean, that was the thing of Carol, was that she brought you an exhibition. She brought it to you in whole. It was total. She knew exactly how she wanted every piece of that hung, every bit of that presented. It was like there was no, and I think that was a very different experience when she started working with you two. Mm-hmm. Was like, she would ask me, well, isn't this like, because she was used to working in artisan centers and she was used to, you know, kind of doing it herself. Yeah. And the idea that there were people being paid to do it for her just it didn't quite sit well with her in some ways. It was, you know.
Totally.
Yeah, it just didn't fit in her worldview. I mean, there were so many things about it. She told me once that the reason the rattles started to actually rattle them was Al. It wasn't her at all. It wasn't her idea to do that at all. It was Al who did that. Mm-hmm. And then she realized how crazy it was. So mm-hmm. I like the way that they, you know, they took the parts of the art world that they wanted and left the other parts that they didn't want behind. And that was very much the choices that both of them made around what they were doing and how they were doing it.
Yeah, that's an interesting comment.
Al would start his concerts 10 minutes early at the Western Front, just to throw him in, yeah. Out, just to use his power.
I love that. Well, I was just going to say that I also love Carol's ambition, though. So whether, you know, we taking parts of the art world that they wanted and didn't want, leaving those that they didn't want behind. But when I first started meeting with Carol about this exhibition, she had a floor plan for her retrospective already done. And it was complete. And it would need, you know, 5 Belkins to do it. But she thought very clearly about that. And I think about, you know, the inlet is being shown for the first time, even though it is a work that has been in process for at least a decade. But, you know, it's 40 to 60 feet long, and there's yeah. not a lot of spaces that can accommodate that mm-hmm. scale. And her ambition, you know, has to get built out depending on either, you know, the size of a studio she has or the venue that's going to receive the work. And so Dinah said that, you know, the Bösendorfer for Al Neal is her largest rattle, but that's not true because other rattles have burned, but also there's a Surrey rattle here, and it's one component of a 60-foot-long rattle that there is a couple of images and documentation of it in the print gallery. But when after it was shown at the unit pit, she couldn't store it, and so the elements were sent out to reside at different people's homes. And that's another project, would be to try and reassemble them mm-hmm. all. But the scale is huge. The ambition is very big. Mm-hmm. I think that's really exciting.
Yeah, that's an important point. Thank you for bringing it up.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think
that's true.
I mean, this piece was huge. She put this together for me 10 years ago, and this is only, like, there were at least twice as much as this.
There's components missing.
It was...
Even the Belkin can't accommodate it all. Yeah.
There was nowhere in town. She kept saying, well, where can I show this? And I was like, I have no idea. There's nowhere to contain, you know. Where do you show a 60-foot installation? There's not many places.
And I, off the top of my head, I don't know how big the work was at the Vancouver Art Gallery where the streets are paved with gold, but that's a huge installation.
It was a huge
that
install.
Spilled over many, many feet. Yeah. Are there any other comments or questions?
Just when you were talking about the writers that influenced her, Al was a writer, published a novel called Chums, for instance.
Al is also on her list, yeah.
Her partner, so yeah. I didn't quite yet, Jesus, yeah. And I was kind of like a little surprised that Al wasn't on the list. And I'm sure
you didn't read the whole list.
I didn't read the whole list. Yeah.
Okay.
Selections. Yeah. No, Al's definitely on the list. There's a lot of musicians on the list. And there are other artists on the list. Yeah.
She talked about they would make this assemblage together, and so they would be collaborating, but mostly Al will be sitting drinking his beer on the porch and saying, no, move it 2 feet over this way, or move it there. And it was, yeah, she was talking about the whole process of making these pieces with Al. They were quite hilarious. And then finally she would just walk away. He would just walk away and said, oh, you know what you're doing, do it yourself.
If you're interested, there is one collage right on the back wall closest to the door here that shows one of the beach assemblage at the Blue Cabin. Mm-hmm. I saw another hand. Yeah. Oh, no. Okay. Well, thank you so much to the panelists, Glenn, Dinah, and Kimberly. And thank you all for coming out. And I am very interested if people have comments that they didn't ask today to please, you know, bring them forward to me. I think you're trying to think more widely. Thank you. Okay, Ian. Oh, yeah. Well.
You can introduce
Working on it.